Good morning. Good to see everyone out this morning. I want to welcome our visitors. We're glad you've chosen to be with us. We're glad to see those joining with us on our live stream through our Facebook page. Hopefully our internet connection is a little better than last week, but we are happy to see each and every one of you here this morning. As it was stated in the announcements, this coming Friday begins our local themed gospel meeting titled Standing Fearless in Fearful Times. I put this together after I put together the workshop that we had for preachers in Tampa, Florida at the beginning of the month. And so what I wanted to do to introduce this series to you is to present what I presented at that workshop in Tampa, a lesson titled Battle at the Valley of Elah, taking our text from 1 Samuel 17. Those familiar with the text are saying, wait a minute, we just talked about David versus Goliath back in March from this same text. Well, this is done just a little bit differently. We did talk about that story, and we went through that entire account back in March. But I want to present it to you the way I did in the context of standing fearless in fearful times. What I hope to do is by the end of this, is give you a new appreciation, if you don't already have it, for this dark time in Israel's history. As Goliath is going to issue a challenge for 40 days. I want you to kind of put yourselves there at the battle lines, on the sidelines, watching that, and feel and see the fear, smell the fear in the air as we put ourselves there, as we take a look at this from the standpoint of standing fearless in fearful times among fearful people. What we find is when we open 1 Samuel 17, we find that this takes place sometime after 1 Samuel 16, where Samuel anoints David. We know by this time, if we're reading it from the beginning of 1 Samuel, we know that God has left King Saul. He has taken David, this little shepherd boy, out of the field. He has made him king in Saul's place, but he has not installed him as king yet. Saul is still king over Israel. David, though, has been introduced in 1 Samuel 16. Sometime after that David was anointed as king in 1 Samuel 16, we find that there is war. The Philistines have gathered together against Israel. The two sides are camped opposite each other across the Valley of Elah. We're told the Israelites are camped on one mountain, the Philistines on the other mountain, and this valley in between. And we find that in 1 Samuel 17, 1 through 3. As I was putting this together, I was reminded that later on we're going to see this spelled out, but this doesn't change it. In 1 Kings chapter 20 and verse 28, when we talk about the time of King Ahab over the northern 10 tribes of Israel, the northern kingdom, God taught a lesson to Ahab, and he taught a lesson to the Syria by telling them that he is Lord of the God of the mountains, and he is Lord over the valleys. God is the God of the mountains. God is the God of the valleys. You can't go one to one and escape him. So God of the mountains and God of the valleys is here in this account. The 40 days of Israel's army enduring the challenge of Goliath. Their freedoms are in the balance of that outcome should a man step forward. So there's going to be real fear. There's going to be anxiety. There's going to be doubt. This passage is a triumph of courage, but it shows the real fears of uncertainty, socio-economical fears, persecution fears, political unrest, lack of spiritual faith, and lack of spiritual growth. War always brings out fear and doubt. As we talk about this, I'm going to bring out some phobias. And as I talk about these phobias, I want you to understand, I know that they most likely did not recognize the same phobias that we talk about today. But as we talk about phobias, I know in our culture it's very common for us to talk about phobias in the sense of it's an irrational fear. The person with that phobia, though, even if they admit it's an irrational fear, it's very real to them. It's something that they have to fight to overcome. And so as we talk about the fears that are here on these battle lines, as they're drawn up, mountain against mountain, and meeting in the valley between. I read a story, an article, titled Millennials Fear Catastrophic War by Peter Maurer. He's the president of the International Committee of the Red Cross, the ICRC. They had a World Economic Forum in 2020, so this happened last year. And this article that came out from this meeting they had, or this gathering together, they said they did a study on 16,000 millennials aged 20 through 35. And they found that 54% of those surveyed, 54% felt that a nuclear war was likely in the next 10 years. And they expressed deep, paralyzing fear over this, so that nucleomitophobia was expressed. That is the fear of nuclear war. They had traumatophobia, fear of war, injury, wounds, and well-being. They had fears that are polemophobia. That simply means fear of war. Well, I'm wondering, as we read this account about the Israelites and know what the balance or what the outcome is in the balance, did they possibly have a fear of war? Because we don't see them do a lot of fighting. They're standing on their side. The Philistines are on their side. Because they know once they clash, there's going to be some well-being that's challenged. There's going to be some health that's going to come to an abrupt end. War brings about uncertainty and doubt. So one of the first fears we're going to be looking at as we get into this text, we find in 1 Samuel 17, 12 through 20. We find Jesse was worried about his three oldest sons who were fighting for King Saul. And so he's going to send David to bring them supplies and bring back news of their welfare. 1 Samuel 17, 12 through 20, this embodies that uncertainty of war. When Jesse is going to worry about his three oldest sons, Eliab, Abinadab, and Shammah, who were fighting for King Saul. He hasn't heard word back. He wants to know, how is the war going? It's been 40 days since they've been gathered together. They could be dead. They could be wounded. They could be scattered, missing in action. These are some real concerns. And we see that embodied here in just this account. And who knows how many other Israelite parents, husbands and wives, are worried about sons and husbands and fathers. Just this one account just embodies all of that uncertainty of war. Uncertainty can include the fears of health or well-being. Traumatophobia is the fear of war, the fear of injury, the fear of wounds, the fear of well-being, or the loss of well-being. You know, Jesse's solution to his fears of uncertainty and anxiousness was David. He put his solution to his fear in David. You go, find out what's happening, and bring me news back. You know, as I think about the uncertainty of war and that the phobias associated with that, I know there have been countless wars and countless different examples we could use, but I could not help but think of the Sullivan family from 1942 during World War II. November 1942, all five of the Sullivan brothers from Waterloo, Iowa, assigned to the U.S. Navy light cruiser Juno, were killed when their ship sank in the Battle of the Guadalcanal. 2 months go by, and their mother, Mother Aleda, and her husband Tom, back in Waterloo, Iowa, still have no word on the welfare of their sons. They were dealing with uncertainty and anxiety for nearly 2 months. Finally, in early January of 1943, Aleta Sullivan wrote this to the Department of the U.S. Navy. I am writing you in regard to a rumor going around that my five sons have been killed in action back in November. A friend from here came and told me she got a letter from her son, and he heard that my five sons were killed. I am to christen the USS Tuwasa on February 12th at Portland, Oregon. If anything has happened to my five sons, I will still christen the ship as it was their wish that I do so. I hated to bother you, but it has worried me so that I wanted to know if it was true. So please, tell me. Can you imagine waiting 2 months to find out if a rumor you heard from someone else that says he served in that area and that all five of your sons went down with the ship? Well, that letter prompted the U.S. Navy to send word on January 11th, 1943, and they had to give her the bad news. Lieutenant Commander Truman Jones sat in their living room, and he told Tom and Aleta and their son Albert's wife, Kina, as they gathered in the family's living room, I'm afraid I'm bringing you very bad news. Then he goes on to list their names. Albert, Francis, George, Joseph, and Madison all are missing in action in the South Pacific. At the behest of the Navy, President Franklin D. Roosevelt wrote a personal letter of condolence. And according to the Navy Times, the Sullivans are still the single greatest wartime sacrifice of any American family in our nation's history. War brings about uncertainty, doubts, and all the fears that go with that. And we see all of that embodied here with Jesse, putting his solution in David to bring back some word, some closure, something. And that's certainly what Mama Aletta was looking for to the Department of the U.S. Navy in 1942. So as we get into this account, we look in 1 Samuel 17, 1 through 11. In verse 16, 24, and verse 32, we find the Philistines and Israel on each side of the Valley of Elah. Goliath challenged Israel for 40 days. And what he's challenging is a winner-take-all. The loser would serve the winner. The freedom of each army was at stake. And three times we read in this account, in verse 11, 24, and verse 32, the Israelite army was afraid. And that David, a shepherd, accepted the challenge. Not one of the soldiers, not one of the commanders, not the king, not the prince, but a shepherd is the one that's going to take up that challenge. But for 40 days, the Israelites heard the challenge and they were terrified. I want to talk about that terrifying nature that they had. And I want you to put yourself there on the sidelines and kind of think about these types of fears that they must have had, what was going through their mind for 40 days, twice a day, morning and evening, 80 times they have heard this challenge. There were not only the fears of uncertainty, but the fears of socio-economical. And what I mean by that is the winner takes all scenario that Goliath proposed was that the losers would become their slaves. They would serve the Philistines. No longer free, their businesses no longer theirs, their money given as tribute to Philistia. And in most cases, as it was in that ancient world, in any time that slavery has been there, not only their jobs were not their own, their bodies would not be their own. Their freedom, wholesale, was at stake. And whoever stepped into the ring, stepped into that valley of Elah to face Goliath. Everything rested on that person. Perhaps they were experiencing dulophobia. It's the fear of slavery. Phylacophobia, the fear of imprisonment. Basanophobia, the fear of torture. For certainly all three of these things could be their fate if one of their own stepped into the Valley of Elah and lost to the champion of Gath. The fears of persecution. The Philistines had already proven themselves hostile to the Israelites back in 1 Samuel 13, 19 to 22. At a time that they had oppressed them, they would not allow them to operate blacksmiths. So they were already controlling what tools they could make. They could only make tools, they couldn't make implements of war. So they'd already taken away their ability, in the Philistines' mind, to defend themselves. And in fact, in this account, we can read that there are only two swords in all of Israel. One that belonged to King Saul, and one that belonged to Jonathan, the prince. And I want you to think about that as we go forward into the story, because David is going to say something and make a promise that's going to bring our minds back to how many swords were here in Israel. Two. Because the Philistines had already oppressed them that they couldn't make weapons of war. We've heard a lot in our time, in our culture, about xenophobia. Xenophobia is described as fear or hatred of foreigners and strangers. And if you do a little word history on xenophobia, you find out that this is more of a more recent definition of this. A little later on, I'm going to tell you the original definition of xenophobia. But part of that fear or hatred of foreigners and strangers often is expressed by persecution and oppression. And so xenophobia was a real fear here as they faced what might come with their defeat. Then in 1 Samuel 17, in verses 8 through 11, they had political unrest. This is a real fear. What's going to happen if the king is deposed? Even the Israelite king, King Saul himself would be a slave of the Philistines. He would not be exempt. And as we find out later, as the Philistines do kill him on Mount Gilboa at the end of 1 Samuel, he was highly sought after and prized by the Philistines. If they had lost, they weren't going to give up on getting him. Questions must have abounded as to whether King Saul could keep them safe or not. Question must have abounded of whether they would even keep their national identity. Would they be able to worship God the way they wanted to? Maybe their minds are going back to when they lived in Egypt and how oppressed they were then. Politicophobia is the fear of politics or the fear of government. I think there's a lot of people that might have politicophobia today. But this was a very real fear then. The fear of lack of faith or growth. In 1 Samuel 17, 11, 24, 26, 32, and 36 through 37, there was real lack of faith fears going on here. David saw their fear. He wondered why they feared this giant who dared to, quote, taunt the armies of the living God. David questions, why are you listening to this for 40 days? He's immediately taken before King Saul and tells him, no man should be afraid any longer, for he would challenge Goliath, and God would deliver him into his hands. In modern vernacular, he goes to King Saul and says, this guy, I got this. Don't worry about that. David goes and says, I'll take care of it. There is a phobia called a tichyphobia, and it's a fear of weakness or a fear of failing. When I read about a tichyphobia, it says it can completely paralyze you. It can hinder you from doing what you need to do, because you're so afraid that you might fail. You're so afraid that you might show weakness that you just don't do anything. Think of the Israelites and what's happening here. They are terrified, we're told, in three times. They're terrified. There's a lot resting on the person that's going to step into the Valley of Elah. Do you think maybe he's got a tichyphobia going on? That fear of failing, the fear of weakness, the guy that's going to go down in history as the guy that caused the slavery of the nation, the king in chains. As I was reading about this, it also says that a tichyphobia can be applied to faith, that it can paralyze and hinder you spiritually. You're so afraid that what you do is going to be looked at as weakness, or what you're going to do is going to fail, that you don't do anything. Not for your fellow man, and not for God. And here in this case, I wonder if this phobia was very real. No Israelite soldier, not the crown prince, and not even the king, would challenge Goliath. Then we come back. We talked about Jesse's uncertainty. I want to come back to the idea of uncertainty and talk about it from the soldier's standpoint. In 1 Samuel 17, 36 to 37, and 40 through 43, what must the army of Israel felt when they saw little unarmored David take the challenge and walk into the Valley of Elah? After all that we've put on the line, after everything that's on the table, everything that's at stake, you see little David, unarmored, considered a youth, so he's not yet 20, can't even be numbered among the soldiers, take the field. What do you do? Think about that. You're saying, well, we're all going down together. This is it. It's over. He has no sword. He has no spear. He does have a staff. But what good is that against the giant of Gath? Oh, look, and he's got a sling and some pretty little rocks. We're doomed. Goliath mocked him. And it makes me wonder, as Goliath mocked him, what did his own countrymen think? I wonder if they're thinking the sanity of King Saul. Because he went to King Saul, he sent out from King Saul, takes the field at Valley of Elah. And the soldiers must have been thinking, Saul's lost his mind. We're all doomed. Their freedom rested on his scrawny little shoulders. And I come back to that word xenophobia. I told you that commonly, more recently, has come to mean fear or hatred of foreigners and strangers. As I was looking at the etymology of this phrase, though, this phobia, originally it was just referred to as the fear of the unknown. Think about that. How it morphed into the fear of foreigners or strangers. And as I looked at it, the fear of the unknown went to unknown peoples, unknown groups of peoples, strange happenings, strange circumstances, strange situations. Basically, you find yourself facing the fear of the unknown and you panic. That's what happens. It's really the fear that's described, really the fear of anything beyond one's comfort zone or control. As you're standing on the battle lines and you see David take the field of Elah, the valley of Elah, to face Goliath, there's nothing you can do about it. The challenge has been answered. It can't be taken back. And no matter how big and brawny and strong you thought you were as a soldier of Israel, no matter what arms you're carrying and armor you're wearing, there's nothing you can do to take the shepherd crook and bring little David back and say, no, let me do it. It's too late. And so now the fear of the unknown is in the air. What on earth is going to happen? So xenophobia is a real fear in the air. Because as we talk now, focus in from the sidelines into the valley of Elah, we talk about our challengers. Goliath is the challenger. His height is approximately 9 foot 9 inches. Some scholars argue for a 7 to 8 foot range, depending, it all depends on the size of the cubit. But in 1 Samuel 17:33, he's described as a warrior. In verse 4, a 9 foot champion. Verses 8 to 10, he defies the armies of God. Verse 11, he's feared by the Israelites. Verse 44, he relies on his own power to defeat David. He's relying on his own prowess. He curses David by his gods, verse 43. Verses 5 to 6, he wears a bronze helmet, a full coat of bronze armor. That armor in verse 5 is talked about as scale armor, which weighed 5,000 shekels of bronze. What that comes to in today's terms, approximately 175 pounds. He's wearing 175 pounds of bronze on his body. Then it talks about he carries a sword in verses 6 to 7 and verse 45. He carries a sword, a spear, and a javelin. The spearhead weighed 600 shekels of iron. In today's standards, that would be 15 pounds. He's able to hold something with the head of it weighing 15 pounds. That's going to go through a man. If he throws that, it's going to go through you. It's not going to stick in you like a pincushion. It's going to go right through you. This guy is formidable. He keeps his shield bearer in front of him so he's not alone. His shield bearer with the shield is specifically stated in verse 7 and 41 to be standing in front of him. So he's there to help him and give him a shield if he needed it. But yet we read in verses 49 to 51, he's going to suffer a humiliating death, struck with a rock and ultimately beheaded. And taking that challenger's challenge, taking the accepting it, so the contender is David. Israelite shepherd, verse 15. Verse 42, he's handsome, but he's a boy. In verse 26, he defends the armies of God. Verse 37, he expresses confidence in God. He does not fear Goliath. The fear is on the Israelite army. David shows absolutely zero fear from the moment he comes onto the scene. He relies on God's power to defeat Goliath, not his own, verses 46 to 47. He proclaims the Lord's name while facing Goliath, verse 45. Verses 38 to 39, he wears no armor. Saul tried to put his own armor on him. But remember, Saul stands head and shoulders above every man in Israel. David could barely walk. So he wears no armor. But he does take what he knows. In verse 40, he carries a staff, 5 stones, and a sling. In verse 48, he stands alone to face Goliath. In verse 49, he kills Goliath with a single stone. You know, it wasn't David's size or physical stature that won the day, but his heart. This was a lesson God taught Samuel when he anointed him as king back in 1 Samuel 16 and verse 7. The Lord said to Samuel, do not look at his appearance when he's looking at Eliab, the oldest. Do not look at his appearance or at the height of his stature, because I've rejected him. For God sees not as man sees. For man looks at the outward appearance, but the Lord looks at the heart. David proves it here. He has the heart that God wanted in every soldier there. Imagine if every soldier there had the heart of David. The Philistines would never have been able to oppress Israel. You know, there's a book called David and Goliath, Underdogs by Malcolm Gladwell. He points out, in his opinion, David brought a gun to a knife fight. He does point out that ancient slingers practiced on targets up to 200 yards away, and they could hurl stones at 70 miles per hour. That'll also fail you. That'll also take you down. It seems David was proficient with his sling, giving him the advantage of range. But lest we focus on that and say, oh, David had the advantage of range, because he does. We also need to remember that no other Israelite slinger or archer took the challenge. David thought outside the box. They're looking at Goliath's weapons and saying, I have to go against that man and stand toe to toe. David says, no, there's more than one way to kill a giant. And David steps into the ring. David's courage was not in his personal stature, not in his military training, but from his faith in God, because he knew God is bigger than any giants. And as he states to Goliath, the battle belongs to the Lord. So as we look at the fight in 1 Samuel 17, in verses 38 to 40, we find that in verses 33 through 47, actually, David fought a lion and a bear, and he tells King Saul that God would deliver Goliath. In verses 38 to 40, David wore no armor and no sword, but took what he was used to in battle. So we read in verse 40, he took his stick and chose for himself five smooth stones from the brook and put them in the shepherd's bag, which he had even in his pouch, and his sling was in his hand, and he approached the Philistine. Now, I like to say, David took more than one rock because there was the possibility he might miss. And he was going to use everything that he had before he had to close in combat with his staff. But David was prepared either way. Whether it took one stone or he had to sling all five, whether he had to close in combat with his staff, David was confident God was going to deliver this giant just as he delivered the lion and the bear that came against his father's flock. And then in verses 45 to 47 and verse 50, I just want to read this section. Then David said to the Philistine, you come to me with a sword, a spear, and a javelin. But I come to you in the name of the Lord of hosts, the God of the armies of Israel, whom you have taunted. This day the Lord will deliver you into my hands, and I will strike you down and remove your head from you. What does David have in his hands? A staff, a sling, and some stones. Only two swords in Israel, King Saul's and Jonathan's. And David says, I'm going to take your head. And I will give the dead bodies of the army of the Philistines this day to the birds of the sky and the wild beasts of the earth, that all the earth may know there is a God in Israel. And that all this assembly may know, the Lord does not deliver by sword or by spear, for the battle is the Lord's, and he'll give you into our hands. And then we jump down to verse 50, and it says, thus David prevailed over the Philistine with a sling and a stone, and he struck the Philistine and killed him, but there was no sword in David's hand. So as we talk about that fight, one of the things that impresses me so much about this is that we read in verses 48 to 51, David ran to the battle line. David ran to the battle line. I imagine that if an Israelite soldier got into the Valley of Elah with Goliath, there's going to be a lot of dancing, some footwork, trying to gauge the other one's prowess and weaknesses. The chinking is that 175-pound armor. There's going to be some cautious maneuvering, right? David runs to the battle line. I just imagine the sling already working. It says David ran quickly toward the battle line to meet the Philistine in verse 48. And as he's running, so he does this on the run, he put his hand in his bag and took from it a stone and slung it and struck the Philistine on his forehead. And the stone sank into his forehead, so he fell on his face to the ground. He doesn't go backward, he falls face forward. In verse 51, then David ran and stood over the Philistine and took his sword and drew it out of its sheath and killed him and cut off his head with it. When the Philistines saw their champion was dead, they fled. Verse 51 to 54, the Israelite army sees the Philistines had no conviction. The Philistines had no way they were ever going to fulfill their promise to serve Israel, because Goliath wasn't going to lose. they had nothing to lose, like the Israelites did. But when they saw their giant of Gath go down and the head in David's hand, they ran. And the Israelite army chased and plundered them, we're told, in verses 51 to 54. See, the Philistines fled when they saw their champion Goliath was dead. And I think that while he was laying there, when he goes down face first, I think there is this moment of a gasp from the Philistines and the Israelites. And there is this moment of, is he going to get up? The referee's not done counting yet. You know, one, two, three. And they're going, get up, get up. If you're rooted for a fight and your champion goes down and the referee starts to count and you're on your feet yelling, get up, get up. There's still a chance. They're yelling, get up. But when he takes the head, it's over. The count is done. The battle is won. And the army is in flight. And the Israelite army pursues. And they plunder them and defeat them that day. You see, when we talk about David's courage, his courage was not grounded in anything that he possessed. His courage was not grounded in any training that he had. His courage was in his faith in God. And because of his courage and his faith in God, it let him stand fearless in fearful times among fearful people. And he won the day. And as we talk about all those fears, I want to remind you of our list of fears here. Uncertainty, socioeconomical, persecution, political unrest, lack of faith, or lack of growth. In 1 Samuel 17, verses 26, 32 to 37, and 45 to 47, the solution to all their fears was David. All eyes were on David. Because no one else is in this valley of Elah. Both armies are camped on each mountain. Goliath's in there challenging. At this particular time of the day, David takes that challenge, and all eyes are on David because everything depended on that outcome. But David knew the real solution all along, and that is God, not David. He asked, who is this uncircumcised Philistine that he should taunt the armies of the living God? He told Saul that God delivered the lion and the bear into his hands, and Goliath will be just like one of them. He had proved God in private. Now he would prove God in public. To him, Goliath was a predator of the flock and was no different than the lion or bear. God had delivered that lion and bear into David's hands, so God would deliver Goliath into his hands. David even told Goliath. He told Saul. He told Goliath. God has this battle. God will deliver you into our hands. You see, this is not the story of David saving his people. This is the story of God saving his people. Because David had the faith and courage to be used by God. David had that courage to stand up and take on the tough job. David was truly the shepherd king Israel needed, who relied not on his own strength, but the strength of God. And David is going to demonstrate this over and over as king over Israel. One of my favorite passages in the Old Testament regarding David is not 1 Samuel 17, but in 1 Chronicles 18. We don't have time this morning to read it. In fact, we're nearly out of time as it is. But I encourage you to read 1 Chronicles 18. I'm just going to summarize what you're going to find there. As king, David took on the tough jobs. He did the jobs no one else would do. Not that they couldn't do it, they wouldn't do it. In 1 Chronicles 18, as king, David defeated and he subjugated all the enemies of Israel that oppressed them from the time of the judges up till King Saul, with only one exception. And that was the Mesopotamians from Judges 3, 7 to 11. He did not take an army and go all the way to Mesopotamia. He left them alone. They had been defeated. They were out. But every enemy surrounding Israel that had oppressed them from the time of the judges all the way up to King Saul, David defeated them, he subjugated them, and they paid him tribute. So that David extended the borders from the inheritance of Israel to the borders of Egypt, to the south, and all the way to Syria in the north. David left for his son Solomon an empire. Not just a kingdom. An empire. Because David did all this by the power of God, because of his faith. He let nothing and no one stand in his way. David took on the tough jobs and did what no one else would do. One of the lessons that I want us to get out of this is that God, the God of David, is your God. He is the living God. 1 Samuel 17:26 and verse 36. He delivers his people, verse 37 and 47. He can deliver by many or by few. 1 Samuel 17:46, and we also see Jonathan have this faith in 14 verse 6. But I want to read Ephesians 3:20 through 21. Because this is the God that we serve. Now to him who is able to do far more abundantly beyond all that we ask or think, according to the power that works within us. To him be the glory in the church and in Christ Jesus to all generations forever and ever. Amen. It has been pointed out by men far smarter than me in the Greek that this word far more abundantly means superabundant. That's how we'd put it in modern vernacular. In the Greek, it means superabundant. And he spells it out here, beyond all that we ask or think. God is able to do far more than what we can ask or think. I read this to you back in March. I want to read it again because I like it as far as Ephesians 3:20 through 21 goes. In a book called In the Presence of My Enemies by Dale Ralph Davis, he has this excerpt in pages 114 to 115. Years back, the Daily Bread devotional booklet passed on a fascinating story. During World War II, a farmer in Sussex, England, sent some money to the Scripture Gift Mission, semi-apologizing that it wasn't more. But he said the harvest on his farm had been disappointing due to a lack of water. He also mentioned he was very fearful because the Germans were dropping so many bombs, and he asked for the mission staff's prayers that he and his family might be spared. One staff member replied, so they sent the farmer a reply. One staff member replied that although they couldn't ask the Lord that no bombs would fall on his land, and the author of the book says, maybe that was too specific. No, why was prayer limited here? They said, we couldn't ask for that. They would pray that, quote, God's will in the matter would prevail. Not long after the farmer received that reply, a huge German missile crashed down on his place. No family members or livestock were injured. It turned out it was a dud, but that bomb went so deep into the ground it liberated a submerged stream. The spring kept flowing and provided irrigation not only for this farmer, but all his neighbors. The next year's donation was a lot larger. See, God did far more abundantly, according to this story, than what was even asked. God is bigger than any giants in your life. And the fact of the matter is, like David, you must face them with courage and with faith. We're going to be called upon to accept these challenges. We're going to have the courage and the faith to step into those valleys and to take on those giants. What happens when saints today face fears of uncertainty? Socioeconomical fears, persecution, political unrest, lack of faith, lack of growth. Oftentimes, and I'm not going to say this is 100% of the time, and I'm not saying this defines 100% of the people in this audience, but most of the time, the solution to all these fears is the preacher, the elders, the deacons, or the spiritually mature in the group. And all eyes focus on the congregation's leadership, that spiritually mature member that everyone looks to for the answers, or the preacher. And I'm going to tell you, just as we see in this lesson, the preachers, the elders, the deacons, the spiritually mature know the true solution, and that is God. So this morning, when people are facing these types of fears, and fears that aren't even listed in this account, if all eyes focus on you, if you're that spiritually mature friend that they have, that they come to, if you're no friends that are in other congregations and they're looking, focusing their eyes on that, on the elders or the deacons or the preacher there, if all eyes focus on you, you need to be like David. I need to be like David and set the record straight and refocus those eyes on the living God who is bigger than any giants, any fears that they might face. I want to remind you of Colossians 3:1-3 as we get ready to close. Therefore, if you've been raised up with Christ, keep seeking the things above, where Christ is seated at the right hand of God. Set your minds on the things above, not on the things that are on earth. For you've died, and your life is hidden with Christ in God. focus our eyes on Jesus. He is the solution. When we focus our eyes here on earth, we see the giants. We see what they're armed with. We see their training. We see their armor. And we say, we can't do it. But if our eyes are focused on God, on Jesus seated at the right hand of God, victorious, we don't see the giant. We see the God who is bigger than that giant. Hebrews 12, 1-3 says, therefore, since we have so great a cloud of witnesses surrounding us, let us also lay aside every encumbrance and the sin which so easily entangles us. Let's run with endurance the race set before us, fixing our eyes on Jesus, the author and perfecter of faith, who for the joy set before him endured the cross, despising the shame, and has sat down at the right hand of the throne of God. For consider him who has endured such hostility by sinners against himself, so that you will not grow weary and lose heart. Jesus did all that he did so that our eyes can focus on him and know it can be done. We can be victorious. 1 Peter 5, 6, and 7 says, therefore, humble yourselves under the mighty hand of God, that he may exalt you at the proper time, casting all your anxiety on him, because he cares for you. In place of that anxiety, casting all your anxiety, insert fears, your burdens, your cares. Cast it all on him. Go to him in prayer, because he is the solution. He cares for you. Whether you are in leadership or have ever served in leadership, whether you are the preacher, whether you are the spiritually mature member of the Lord's church, the admonition here is take on those tough jobs and see who follows you into the fray. When David led by example and took on the giant, Israel's army followed him, and they won a great victory. The giants of today include worldliness, compromise, peer pressure, indifference, false doctrine, fears of all kinds, lack of faith, lack of growth. This is not an exhaustive list, but it certainly demonstrates the battles that we must fight, the giants that we must face. And like David, we don't dare face them alone. We don't dare face them with our own strength, but we must rely on and trust and faith in God's strength. You know, I mentioned earlier when David went in there, while Goliath had his shield bearer and David went in alone, David pointed out he wasn't really there alone, was he? We don't dare take on those battles alone either. Let's focus our eyes on Jesus, because we will face the giants of the world. And when we do, we need the courage and faith of David to overcome, that we might stand fearless in fearful times among fearful people. And that's the theme of this local themed gospel meeting coming up in a week. And all the speakers of that are going to be speaking on passages and texts about fears that were very real to the people in that time, how they were overcome, and how it relates to us today. And I beg that you might attend and give them your attention. And as we close this morning, we need to have that courage to be that one that, even if everyone else is on the sideline, be the one that steps into the Valley of Elah. Be the one that takes on the giant, knowing that you are not alone, that God is with you. This morning, if you're not a Christian, you need to become one. To have those promises of God, that no matter where you go, he is with you. The promise of an eternal home in heaven with him belongs to the faithful. And if we can assist you this morning, you can repent of your sins. You can be baptized into his name, having those sins washed away, that you might live no longer for yourself, but for the one that died and paid that great debt of sin. And this morning, if you're here as one that has walked away or not lived the way that you should, maybe hasn't been courageous as you should, shying away from those tough jobs, now's the time to recognize that and make it right. Repent and come back to God. And if we can assist you in any of these things this morning, we stand ready to do so with the waters of baptism or the prayers of the righteous on your behalf. Come forward, let it be known now, while together we stand and sing.